Jonathan M.S. Pierce is a philosopher, author, columnist, and public speaker with an interest in writing about almost anything from skepticism to science, politics, and morality to the environment. Essentially everything, because everything is philosophy. He's a former teacher and is now battling primary progressive multiple sclerosis. He can no longer play football with his twin boys, but he can write a good column and book. And remarkably, bravely, he went to Ukraine earlier this year on an arduous journey around the front lines. Now, that was the subject of our first conversation. If you like what we're going to talk about in this episode, I strongly recommend you go back and check that conversation as well. But before you do, also please check out the validated Ukrainian charities in the description of the video. It's never been more important than it is now to help Ukraine remain resilient and to push back against genocidal Russian aggression. Jonathan, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. This is very kind of you. I'm looking forward to having a good old chin wag with your good self. Two Jonathans in the same place with the same moral evaluations, I gather, of what is going on over there. And thank you. Thank you.
Well, this could be an interesting challenge, this conversation. Find points of difference, because in the previous conversations, we have not done that. We seem to be broadly aligned on everything. But let's have a look. And
Well,
let's
I do
start
have
with.
something to say. Well, actually, before you start, I do have something to say to that, which is that I get tremendously frustrated that other people can't see the moral conclusions that I so clearly see. Like, this is one of the, as I've said many times before, one of the clearest moral evaluations for any conflict that I know in history. Like, I look at the, I know there are gray areas. Do we talk about NATO encroachment? Do we talk about the impact of the US and Victoria Nuland and et cetera, et cetera? But then, oh, what about actually what Russia were doing, even more so with their influence into Ukraine? But yes, things are complicated, but this isn't that complicated. This is an aggressive nation invading a sovereign, independent nation and doing countless war crimes. It is so obvious to me, and I just get deeply frustrated when people don't get that. And so we should agree, because we, hopefully, Jonathan, our rational minds are communicating together. I despise people. I'm really becoming like more and more so angry about this, but people like David Sacks and Elon Musk online, who have huge megaphones and have got that incorrect moral evaluation, I just don't get how they have. Well, I do understand it. They just get stuck in these information bubbles, and it's kind of feeds on. But it's insanely frustrating to see how people don't agree with the likes of you and I.
It is, isn't it? And there's a whole spectrum of people like that. And I think you've mentioned some of the fairly extreme ones there. It's baffling as to where Elon Musk is getting his information. But you also have people like Jeffrey Sachs and Mearsheimer, who ostensibly have credible academic backgrounds. And indeed, some academics even get a little bit hot under the collar when we lambast them too much. But when you hear people repeatedly suggesting things that align with Kremlin talking points and fly in the face of evidence, history, and contextual knowledge, it's deeply frustrating, isn't it?
Well, so I guess one of the things here is, well, first of all, there's garbage in, garbage out. So if you're putting incorrect ideas into your function machine, you will get an outcome that is incorrect, right? And so we must ask people at Mearsheimer, are they putting garbage in? But yeah, these are clever people. They know what they're on about. I think what is largely happening, or is happening very often, is the idea of US imperialism that is tainting people's narratives about history in general. And there is definitely something to be said about that. So we can look at the history of the US in terms of their foreign diplomacy. I mean, I'm watching at the moment the great series on Netflix at the moment called Turning Point, about the Cold War, which is very good. And it's reminding me about all the influences that the US have had in particularly South America. John Pilger did a great documentary called War and Democracy that looks at US imperialism and says, hang on, there are all these democratically elected governments that the US has in many ways clandestinely got involved in, and they've deposed governments and got themselves deep into the long weeds of politics in somewhere that maybe they shouldn't. Okay, And we can look at that and go, okay, the US does have a history of their kind of capitalistic ideological imperialism. But then to allow that to color almost everything about how you interpret geopolitics in the world means that, you know, if you're taking that baggage into you and you feel so strongly about that and taking that baggage into how you evaluate what's gone on with Ukraine, you can create a narrative whereby Ukraine is being used by the US, and you have blinkers that only look in that direction, and that exonerates everything that Russia does, because you're just not looking over there. You're allowing them to get away with the same kind of activity, but even more insidious and even more nefarious into Ukraine. And then you just look at one side of the coin there, or one side of the calculation, and you assign your blame there. And this is all about US imperialism.
And it is insidious, isn't it? And I this is where the little red flag goes off in my head. If someone is really pointing the finger at US imperialism, whether or not they're marshalling genuine facts or not, if they have not pointed out the imperial activities of Soviet Russia, whose tentacles reached far and wide, and as we see now, saw themselves in some kind of great power conflict, then essentially that doesn't become a credible source for me if they're only pointing fingers in one direction.
Yes, and you also get the problem of, okay, let's blame the US and their imperialism, or the EU and their desire to get Ukraine on side. Or on the flip side, you could say, let's blame Russia for everything and their Soviet legacy and Putin and et cetera, et cetera. But we're forgetting a rather important components in this, and that is Ukraine, right, and Ukrainians. And so when you look at 2014 or before in Ukraine, and you're blaming NATO encroachment or the EU or Newland and US, or likewise Russia and the little green men and the illegal invasion and the Donbass and Crimea, what we should be doing first and foremost is saying, hang on, Ukrainians, you guys live there. What do you all think? And I know there's going to be some confusion as to what you think in some of these areas, but generally, we need to get a really good idea of what Ukrainians think and what they want for themselves of the future. You know, it is no coincidence that as soon as nations came out of the Warsaw Pact, which was you have to be in the Warsaw Pact, they decided off their own backs that they wanted to go to NATO, which is very much a thing of their own free volition, which is an interesting difference between, say, the Warsaw Pact and NATO. One is voluntary and one wasn't. And I think we forget Ukraine's own agency in this four-dimensional game of chess.
And, you know, for those who are saying, oh, yes, but what about this? What about that? You just have to remember 1968 and the Prague Spring, when Russia, that obviously had created the Warsaw Pact as an instrument to exert its will, spearheaded an invasion of Czechoslovakia to stamp out the sort of nascent Prague Spring, trying to create socialism with a human face. And it was supported by tanks and troops from other Warsaw Pact countries. So again, if someone secedes from NATO, let's point this out clearly, it's, oh, well, that's a shame. Goodbye. Unless, of course, it's Hungary, in which case we'd all be rather pleased at the moment to see that. And Warsaw Pact, very, very different reaction. You want to leave our friendly alliance, well, then you're going to be invaded by tanks. And that has an extraordinary echo, I think, in the present day. And unfortunately, there's a goldfish sort of mentality, isn't there, to the media and the public. But 1956, Hungary, 1968, Czechoslovakia, 2022, Ukraine, and of course, 2008, Georgia. There is a long history of Russia using false flags, using puppets, and using fairly flimsy pretexts to invade neighboring countries.
We don't... We're not good enough bettors, I think, in the general public sometimes, as in I'm not a betting person. But if I was, I'd be looking at the form of horses, because I'd be wanting to make the most rational judgment I could in terms of which horse is most likely to win. And I want to use my inductive reasoning, which is reason about, you know, what has taken place in the past to inform my beliefs about what might take place in the future. And as you say, look at the form of the Soviet Union and the Russian Federation, and then get an idea of where the Ukraine conflict fits in terms of the history of the Russian Federation and the Soviet Union. And it seems like this is par for the course. This is exactly what we would kind of expect from someone like Putin. And then you add in all the possibilities, like he could be nearing the end of his life. He could be quite ill. He has no one around him who's going to vie for power off him. He's got a very thin pillar of power where him and a few lackeys around him who aren't very good, purposefully aren't very good. So he's not threatened by anyone decent. Means that there's a power vacuum and he can kind of do what he wants, and he's making decisions that are rational given where he is and the information bubble he lives in, and we can talk about that. But also, you know, possibly if his life isn't going to go on too much longer, then that could explain why he's being quite risky in the sorts of decisions he's making.
Well, there are two topics I want to sort of cover next, fairly chunky ones, actually. One is autocracy and the sort of moral equivalence that is often stated, especially in propaganda and use of violence with you know, democracies. The other one is neo-imperialism. Well, let's come to that one next. So that's a huge kind of topic. But let's start with this one. You've got Putin, you've got Russia. Many of the trolls and so on this channel will say, yes, well, Russia might be doing some bad stuff, yes, but what about you lot, etc.? And they'll talk about the will of the Russian people, Russia this, Russia that, etc., forgetting that Russia is not a real democracy. It's just had the least democratic process in its history since the 90s, a blatantly rigged and falsified election. But we have to remember, since the early 2000s, one could even argue, even into the 90s and Yeltsin's 1996 election and the referendum and so on, where the media was even then being manipulated to support, the incumbent administration, there is no level playing field. There is no opposition that is allowed to freely canvass and exercise the normal process. You're talking about an autocracy that represses and murders its own people, and where people do not have the will to express their own points of view. I would argue they do not have the freedom to create their own point of view. And this is highly problematic, isn't it? It's the effect of internal propaganda and brainwashing means that many, many people will be consuming a manufactured version of the truth, manufactured version of sort of foreign policy and so on it's based on. And we've got to be pretty clear. Many people do not think for themselves, and therefore perhaps their views on foreign policy in an autocracy in some ways are less legitimate. That's going to maybe trigger a few people. But often we'll see equivalence made between autocratic regimes and democratic ones as if they fully represent their populace.
I think what... Think about the Russian people over, you could say forever, but let's arbitrarily say the last 200 years. Tell me, when have they experienced democracy? I mean, that's an open question. So when
not early 90s, you know, nascent experiments in democracy, but extremely flawed. And until, I would say, well, what is democracy? So democracy, if you listen to Karl Popper, is not exercising your vote. Democracy is getting rid of a leader. It's the ability of a system to get rid of a leader that served his time. It's a mechanism for removing an incumbent from power.
Given that peaceful transfer of power as well.
Yes, and peaceful legal transfer of power. Given that definition, it hasn't happened in Russia ever.
So, either it's happened slightly with a little dabbling, a dipping of the toe into the pool of democracy in the early 90s, and then that experiment kind of failed as it turned into an oligarchy.
Yeltsin overturned Gorbachev. Yeltsin never transitioned power from the presidential position to another without, one would say, almost the dark hand or the dark forces underlining it. You went from Putin as prime minister to Putin as president. There's no real
And then changing the laws.
Peaceful transfer of power.
No. And so the point being is that the Russian people have never really experienced democracy. They are incredibly disenfranchised as a population. And so they are malleable because they just don't know how to do democracy. It's almost like they've never really had it. So, you know, when they sort of lost it in that period from the, you know, 1991 to now, they've not really lost anything they've grappled with and got good at. And so, you know, whether it be the SARS or you know, communism to now, they just don't have a track record of experiencing democracy. And that means that they are truly disenfranchised. And you know, when we go to our, you know, families and have sit down and have a dinner with each other, like, I know we're not supposed to talk about religion and politics, or, you know, so okay, go to the pub, we'll all talk about, right, I want this politician to get in, I believe in this party, and then we argue about it at the pub or whatever. Like, Russians literally can't do that. Like, there is, you can talk about an idea, this idealistic understanding of democracy, but like the practicalities of, like, should we have an argument about who should get voted in next? It's just they've never really experienced that. And so there's no history of democracy, and that means that population is even more pliable than any other population would be who's experienced it and lost it, and you'd be hearkening back to that period. They just don't even have that.
Exactly. And since 2012, anyone engaged in politics would have been fairly circumspect about who they spoke with about politics, because you're in the pub, you're even with family members, there's a real risk that you will say these things or put things in writing, and then you'll get a knock at the door, or you'll have coercion placed on you to become an agent of the state and to renounce your points of view. And as we've seen more recently, 5 to 10 year jail terms will accompany that. And if you're lucky, you won't be tortured and beaten in the process.
And there's this idea that there are more internal security services members in Russia than there are armed forces personnel. And if that's the reality of the situation, then you have an iron grip as a leader of the Russian Federation. You have an iron grip on what people think and how they show dissent. And you can't show dissent because, you know, you'll get easily shot if you do, by even family members or whatever. I mean, we're going back, but almost going back 50 years or whatever, 70 years. But, you know, you'll get sent to prison or a gulag equivalent or whatever. It is very difficult to be a believer in democracy in Russia, to have hope for a future. Alexei Navalny, as imperfect as he may have been, was this chance, this opportunity, and that was dashed. And if you are trying to give marks to Putin for controlling his population, he's actually done a pretty good job, I guess, in what has happened with Alexei Navalny, as horrific as that is. He's just managed to constrain his population and their desires for freedom. There's just no liberty in Russia.
Absolutely not. And this is quite a remarkable thing, isn't it? The question here for you is that many of those who are supporting Ukraine, many of those who really sort of tuned in, and not even daily, but feel themselves connected to Ukraine, have identified that there is something there that we value. And it's not the fact they're white. It's not the fact they're Christian. And some of the things the trolls will point out is that they have a democracy that's evolving, and actually a democracy that is supported and actually enabled by an extremely vibrant civil society. You know, we put huge resources in trying to build democracy in Afghanistan and Iraq, and to an extent, both those projects failed. One catastrophically, another one in Iraq, you know, barely has taken hold, given, you know, various interests there, as well as strong sectarian sort of religious divides as well. And yet here is democracy in Ukraine, a country that could help renew our own institutions. And we do not seem to have the same fervor and the same willingness to pump resources into, we don't even have to create the democracy in this case, we just have to support it and sustain it.
This is such It's a massive topic. We are a huge, we are at a huge inflection point in history. And I think we are fighting for democracy and liberal values. And by liberal, I don't mean social moral liberal. I mean sort of ideas of freedom, like classic liberalism. Ukraine stands for all, whether they are exactly that or not, but the fact they're striving for these things is what we should be massively celebrating and assisting in. And on the other side, you have an autocracy that is growing ever more autocratic, that has an ever stronger grip on its population, and liberty there is a dwindling resource where you can't even use the word war. It's still special military operation. And it's terribly disheartening that we aren't in full recognition of exactly what's going on and helping accordingly. Now, this brings me on to something that I think is fascinating. And then there are loads of other branches to this conversation. I don't know whether we'll go there, but Emmanuel Macron has had this kind of road to Damascus moment, which is, I think, fascinating because he's got an interesting popularity, I guess, domestically. He's never been like the most popular person either internationally or within France, but he's centrist, fairly safe pair of hands. But he has suddenly had this moment where France weren't helping massively and are now rhetorically number one nation for helping and are starting to put their money and their actions where their rhetorical mouths have been, or where his mouths have been. Now, what has taken place here? So I think Macron has come to a realization for one reason or another that we are at that point, that this is as serious as we are saying it is, that Ukraine really are on the back foot here and they need as much help as they can get. So I think there was an element of realism in the intelligence he was getting, and possibly a realization that actually Russia were winning the war of hearts and minds and security and natural resources in the Sahel part of Africa, and the kind of neo-colonial French influence there was dwindling and Russia is replacing them. And so Macron, I think, has probably gone, right, okay, the excrement is hitting the fan, and if we don't act now, this will be the beginning of the end for the EU. And if it's the beginning of the end for the EU, it's beginning of the end for democracy and liberty, and we'll go into a pretty dark era potentially. Now, I know there's a lot of me talking, but alongside this, or causing all of this, or heavily involved in this situation, is the Russian disinformation project, where they say, realistically, Russia can't win a war against, and the Institute for the Study of War has just done a report that broadly says this. Russia realizes, I think, they can't win this war militarily. So they can't beat Ukraine with the might of NATO and the EU behind it. So how do they win the war? They need to stop the aid getting to Ukraine, which means they have to undermine the democratic institutions, mechanisms, and elections that are going to vote in the parties who are most likely to support Ukraine with aid. And so Russia's war effort is not only on the battlefronts and the battlefields of Ukraine, but even more so is in our heads, is in the information spaces in the EU, in the UK, in the US, and in the global south, where they are fighting tooth and nail to make sure that they disrupt democratic to disrupt elections and disrupt the ability for the West to support Ukraine.
Well, that leads really well into the second part of that question, which was about neo-colonialism. And I think it's interesting, isn't it, that France has suddenly wake up from being one of the countries that had provided some interesting capabilities, scalp and so on, but in terms of monetary value and volume, was certainly one of the lowest providers of support to Ukraine of the Western powers. They didn't seem to have the same red lines as...
I would slightly say it's always difficult when you look at whole numbers and you think, okay, they've given X amount and this country's given more, like the US has given loads more than everyone else, so it was before. But actually, as a percentage of GDP, the US are in 31st position.
Yes. Well, and France was relatively low in GDP terms as well in 2022 and early 2023.
True, but they were giving more than we gave them credit for because they were doing it through the EU. And their whole way of giving aid has traditionally been through the EU, and we'll give it through these organizations that then give our money. And since we're one of the biggest members of the EU, like loads of the EU budget ends up going, that's going towards Ukraine, ends up actually coming from France and Germany. So you need to add that on to what they've given kind of bilaterally. So, but you're right, they hadn't given much bilaterally, and that seems to be changing. But sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. No, absolutely. But they, right from the start, don't seem to have quite the same red line. Certainly Macron tried the continuation of Minsk by talking to Putin. But I think he's realized that that's not going to go anywhere. In fact, I think he realized in 2022 that really that wasn't going to go anywhere. What but France
rumor,
seems
sorry,
to have
picked up on. Again, but the rumor was that Zelensky asked him to do that. So Macron got a lot of stick for keeping on phoning Putin. And everyone's like, Macron, why are you doing this? You need to help more. But it's apparently the case, so it's come out now, that Zelensky had been asking him to do that. So Macron was the conduit for Zelensky to try peace negotiations through the back door with Putin. So again, Macron might have got the raw end of the stick from public perceptions.
Sure. Sure, but the Minsk process, the Franco-German Minsk process, was built on certain assumptions, which turned out not to be true, certain assumptions about Russia being someone you can negotiate with, rationalize with, that their aims are limited and rational in our foreign policy sense. That clearly is not the case. We don't know if there is any limit to Russia's ambitions, just as its borders are very not well-defined. But I think what France has woken up to is the global nature of the challenge. Russia, as you say, is trying to unseat Western influence across the Sahel, across the African continent, various countries, global south and so on. But it isn't just a fight for influence. It's targeting those countries, those areas where it can make money, either through Wagner providing security forces or gold mines, or perhaps more significantly for France, uranium. There are key materials on which a lot of Western manufacturing wealth is built. And of course, France is more dependent on nuclear than almost any European power. So maybe they've woken up to the global threat that Russia represents. The question here is, why are other countries far less alive to this threat? And if they are, why are they not doing anything about it? It does seem that there's still a mindset this is a local conflict and Russia is still a regional power, but clearly it has aspirations for global hegemony of some sort.
Well, yeah, it's interesting when Medvedev recently, in front of a massive screen, said to a huge Russian audience, Russia has no borders. And then behind him was that big image of a Russia that was basically taking over half of Europe or Ukraine and whatnot. And you're thinking, we should be listening to the propagandists. We should be listening to the Russian politicians. We've got State Duma representatives and others being quite free with their opinions on state TV, saying exactly what they feel about the Ukrainians, about Ukraine, about Europe, about who the enemies are, about using nuclear weapons. Like, we should be under no illusions. Again, this goes back to the question of, like, how do we not see who the good guys and bad guys are so obviously in this conflict? And actually, what I like what Macron did, which I think was super important, I know I haven't answered your question, but what was super important that Macron did is he sat down however many weeks ago and did that half an hour session with a couple of reporters who asked him sort of difficult questions, but it was his opportunity to speak to his nation and say, this is how freaking important the war in Ukraine is and why I am freaked out by it and why you should find this just as important as I do and scary, and why we as France and the EU need to act, right? And that was brilliant. And speaking to the population about such an important thing, just even arranging that shows you how important it was and is to him. And I would love for all the European leaders and for Biden, although it's for partisan in the US, but, you know, Rishi Sunak in the UK to sit down and say, right, I'm going to have a half an hour session on national television where I'm going to tell you quite how important things are over there and how they are important to you guys, to us, and how if we don't succeed here, then it's a zero-sum game here. So if, our influence in the world and our ability to do, you know, the things we are doing at the moment freely will be degraded if Russia gains power, and we need to change that. But I don't know, with regard to France and why no other nation's done that. I know France has been attacked by, you know, cyber warfare recently. Their own hospitals, I think, have been under attack from the Russians fairly directly, which in my opinion is war. Like, it is a warfare. Like, yeah, I see no functional difference between dropping a bomb on a hospital so it stops working and kills people, and screwing up its IT systems so it stops working and it kills people. Like, functionally the same to me. So that is an attack on France, and whether that kind of thing has woken France up as well. It's interesting just now, and I'm looking at this, and this is super important. So disinformation for me is one of the biggest challenges we all face. France is proposing an EU-wide sanctions on Russian companies. France will propose EU-wide level sanctions on Russian companies spreading disinformation, said French Foreign Affairs Minister Stéphane Séjourné, announced on Tuesday. I will propose putting forward a sanctions regime against those who support a regime of disinformation. I think that's super important. And France are taking the lead there in the biggest area of the war for us in general, which is disinformation. But why others haven't woken up? Is there an economic angle to that? So France is being affected more economically. I don't know. I think Germany has woken up, but and they are helping in terms of military aid, if not the Taurus. We get, our perceptions are tainted by the fact that Olaf Scholz has not given the Taurus missile. But aside from that, they are trying to step in. And you've also got the situation where France's own, or Emmanuel Macron's own vision of where the EU needs to be in terms of independence from the US is also aligning with the US not giving military aid for 6 months, that allows him to say, I told you we need to be independent. I told you the EU needs to stand up on its own two feet and have security independence. And this will also feed into manufacturing and security independence in terms of the industrial military complex. So there's so many areas of this that are important, but quite why some of the European leaders around the world haven't been as forthright as Macron. I guess there are so many challenges inside each country and threats from maybe the far right that is itself amplified in their messaging by Moscow. I don't know.
And this, I think, is an interesting point. This is the mindset that we do not understand about Russia. If you take Mearsheim and others, they'll use geopolitical arguments, and they'll use arguments about Russia and history and being invaded so many times. And I think it's important to unpick these narratives. If these narratives are repeated and amplified and taught and fed through, you know, useful idiots and so on, we need to detach them from the historical circumstance and then look at what the regime is actually telling us. Because it's not just a process of lies, it's also a process of editorialization. It's taking out alternative arguments that they don't want you to think about and only giving you the arguments that they do. So painting Russia as the victim is definitely one of them. But I remember very clearly talking to many, many Russians in the 90s, and there's this extraordinary nostalgia for not just the Cold War, but actually a period before, which is the great game against Britain in India. A lot of people in Russia still hold that up as a sort of, for them, a golden age of projecting power and authority and influence against the biggest boy in town, which was Britain. You know, the big enemy, the real enemy. The US is just an inheritor of those same Anglo-Saxon values. And I think this is an interesting mindset. It's the mindset of the kind of, not even a bully, but they want to have the same status as the biggest bully boy in the schoolyard. You know, they don't want to pick the secondary one or just pick on weak people or do that as well. They want to think of themselves having the same kind of status, or they want to be feared like the biggest bully in the playground. And it sounds juvenile, but when you look at Russia's actions, when you look at Putin's actions, that seems to explain them more than any geopolitical theorizing.
I couldn't agree with you more. And what's really fascinating is how the UK still gets blame for certain things that is probably not warranted by the UK. So I think that Russia thinks the UK is a more powerful nation than we really are, right? Which is harkens back to the kind of great game period like you're talking about, where we did have, or it was the back end of our you know, our era of empire. And Russia maybe still sees us in that way. And so when things happen, like a ship blows up, one of the Russian warships blow up, they're like, oh, those are those naval drones that the UK have been doing. And it's like, and they seem to think we have, you know, more powerful spy networks than we really do. I know the UK intelligence is pretty decent considering our size, but we often get the blame almost first, or the US, CIA, yeah. But also the UK is often in there. And I don't think that's generally warranted. And it just shows you that the Russian perception of the UK is of that era. And I think there's a legacy there. And I think it's outdated and not justified. But yeah, so I'd agree. And you can tell also by the amount of times they use the phrase, you used it yourself, Anglo-Saxon. They're forever blaming Anglo-Saxon X, Y, and Z. And of course, you know, that's, that again, harkens back to really Anglo-Saxon heritage of the UK. So yeah, it's just, we are a bit of a bogeyman for them. And but again, I think everyone is a bogeyman for them. And they just want to be, as you say, the big boys on the block. They have these delusions of grandeur that I don't think are realistic for them, given their position geopolitically and economically. I just don't think they have any way of getting there in possibly the way they could have done back in the, you know, last century, given that, you know, I don't think sanctions are going to stop anytime soon. I think the legacy of this war will be hurting Russia for a long time to come, unless there's a complete change of regime and political, the instruments of politics are completely changed. Then I think the invasion of Ukraine will be Putin's most, history will look back very poorly on that decision. I don't think it's going to have done Russia any favors for a very long time.
And that assumes Russia survives the process. And at this point, I think it's touch and go. It really depends on how we support Ukraine. So let's get back to Ukraine. Ukraine is, and its struggle has been described as existential. You know, it's fighting for its existence, fighting for its identity. It's achieved extraordinary things. But we've seen over the last 6 months a lack of ammunition, a so-called ammunition famine, which has caused a degradation of the front lines. It's also, as Zelensky announced this week, it has caused Ukraine not to conduct various offensives that it might otherwise have done if it was properly equipped to do so. So they're forced back onto a defensive position on the battlefield. So, of course, Ukrainians have been creative. They're trying to achieve gains where they can. And usually they're incredibly strategic, so pushing back against the Black Sea fleet, pushing back and using Patriots to deter and take out big chunks of the Russian Air Force. Now we see its long-range drones hitting the Russian oil refining capacity, which is a serious threat, I think, to Russia's war machine. It's perhaps the first serious blow to Putin's credibility and the foundations of his regime in 2 years. And that's a bold statement, but it seems to have got them spooked like nothing else. And yet here we have apparently the US extremely uncomfortable with this strategy. But for Ukraine, it's a strategy to survive, I think, at this point. And they ought to be doing, you know, within the context of the legalities of war. And let's face it, it's entirely proper what they're doing within the definition of war. They're hitting refining capacity. A lot of it is being used for the military industrial complex. They're avoiding civilian areas. That seems to me an entirely legitimate target. And yet it's reported the US is not comfortable with that. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. But if they were to follow what the US is comfortable with, this surely is a path to defeat, because they would have to defeat Russia on the conventional battlefield, but they don't have the equipment to do that, and it's unlikely that they will.
Indeed, Antony Blinken, foreign secretary of the US, has just come out in a press conference with the French literally in the last hour and said we neither support nor assist with the strikes on the oil refineries. Now, there was talk about whether this was the US just positioning themselves in a non-escalatory way such that deep inside the US are like, actually, we don't mind you doing that. That's fine. You can go and hit those oil refineries. We just very publicly have to say, no, we don't agree with that, just so Russia don't think that we're having this proxy war type scenario. However, Zelensky then came out and said, no, I was pressured by the US not to do that, which then put those theories to bed. And so we have this, what I must be an economic scenario whereby Biden is coming up for a re-election in 2024, and we know that inflation and the economy is a huge component of any election campaign, and an incumbent government who has a really good, well-functioning economy will be much better placed to get voted back in. And so if the gas prices start going up because things are happening to oil refineries over in Russia, and we can argue about whether refined products will find their way to the global market and whether crude or, you know, how much that is actually affecting global prices, I don't know. But if Biden sees that those kind of strikes will affect his ability to get reelected, then actually there's a really interesting argument here, because there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that Biden is the better option for Ukraine. They need a trifecta of Biden, the Senate, and the House of Representatives to be under Democratic control in November 2024, so Ukraine get all the help they could get. If it's split or if Trump gets in, Ukraine is in deep trouble, right? And so if Biden has a lower chance of getting voted in because gas prices are going up, then actually that is uncomfortable, and it's horrible for the Ukrainians. But if you're playing the long game, you can see the justification for asking Ukraine not to hit the oil refineries, but instead to hit things like industrial military complex facilities. So I personally, if you had no other concerns for any other nation in the world, you'd be hammering those oil refineries like every day with everything you can. But I can see that this could present problems for Ukraine in the long run, and that's uncomfortable, because going back to the disinformation war that's being waged, Trump is a fan of Putin. Mike Johnson is a fan of Trump. And Mike Johnson, who is a speaker of the House of Representatives, who presently have a majority of one in the House of Representatives, the Republican Party. Mike Johnson doesn't want his seat vacated as a speaker. So he's saying, I believe in Ukraine, but if I put this Ukraine aid to the floor to be voted on, then I might lose my job as speaker. So my job is more important than what my care for Ukraine. And so you have this weird situation where very few people in American politics control whether the US aid, $60 billion of US aid goes from the US to Ukraine. That's been 6 months in the making, and still nothing done. And again, that's disinformation, and that's a Trump, a narcissistic dictator wannabe, liking big strong men like Putin, Bolsonaro, Xi Jinping, Kim Jong-un, and so on and so forth, and Viktor Orban.
And of course, if you place yourself, I mean, this is the interesting dilemma. This is where politics and morality collide, because that calculus is perfectly understandable from Biden's point of view and the domestic scenario. Sullivan, who potentially is the guy actually who was delivering the pressure, it's interesting that it's not Sullivan that's come out today and said that. So you may also have factions and disagreements within. And Blinken is known to be a little more hawkish, although, you know, he was also part of the whole sort of Biden team who gave Putin a bit of a pass the last time round. But there are certainly differences of opinion. If you place yourself in the role of Zelensky, though, he, I think, has been enthralled to the US and far less critical than perhaps he could have been over the last 2 years. And certainly any criticism has been delivered via, you know, I would say back channels rather than publicly. So politically, he's been, I think, extraordinarily sensitive. And he hasn't wanted to seem to be making demands, etc. But it's been 6 months since there were substantial deliveries of aid. His calculus must be that the US is a great ally, but it's been it hasn't been dependable for 6 months. This situation could easily carry on through the rest of the year, and there's a better than even chance that Putin gets in. Now, I meant Trump gets in to the White House. Freudian slip there, yeah. Their calculus must be that Ukraine may not survive. Yes, you know, doing your ally a favor, fair enough. But if it's at the cost of your survival as a nation, if it's at the cost of survival in terms of statehood, and if it's to prevent the genocide of your people, then morally that comes first for him, surely. And that's what this decision is based on.
It's really difficult for Zelensky, because you look at things like the oil refineries and like, I really want to blow them up, and I can blow them up. And not blowing them up means that there's a short-term harm, but then there's this long-term game. And I'm sure he understands that. Look, I think Zelensky is getting really frustrated at the moment, and some of his rhetoric has allowed some of those comments to come out recently, where you're starting to get an idea that actually he's not too happy with the US situation. But also, he knows very well that if he's properly critical, like if I was Zelensky and I was sitting here with my wife and my aides around me, I'd be swearing nonstop about Mike Johnson and the Republican Party, at least the MAGA Republicans, and Donald Trump. I'm sure he's doing that. But he knows that if that criticism becomes public, then the backfire effect in psychology will mean that those criticisms will cause those people to entrench even more in those positions, and they will bring others with them. And you will get this idea where it becomes even more of a partisan divide, where Ukraine is a Democrat thing and not a national security thing, which is already partly an issue. However, there is a broad coalition, supposedly, and I think New York Times has come out with a really interesting, there's a quote in the New York Times article today, I don't have it here, which is basically admitted that there is a broad coalition, or that there is broad. Oh, here it is. So that strongly suggests that the aid package for Ukraine, which has been stalled in Capitol for months amid a Republican resistance, could clear Congress within weeks. So he is looking like Mike Johnson is going to table it. It enjoys strong support.
He's going to be forced to, though, isn't he? They can force his hand. So it might not even be his eventual choice, I think.
Well, yeah, there's so hold that. It enjoys strong support among Democrats and a large coalition of mainstream Republicans. And the main obstacle standing in the way of the House has been Mr. Johnson's refusal to bring it up in the face of vehement hard right opposition in the GOP, sending more aid to Kyiv. So he's doesn't want to lose his seat because of people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who are deeply anti-Ukraine for some weird reason, because they think it's a partisan thing and they live in that information bubble that includes that disinformation that's filtered through from the Kremlin. But there are Republicans who support this, but they are not brave enough to stand up publicly and say, I will support this, because then they might lose their base, who are overtly often Trump supporters because they're seeming to go against Trump and the MAGA wing. And the thing about representatives in the House of Representatives is they are elected every 2 years. So senators are elected every 6 years, representatives every 2 years. So you are always campaigning, and you're campaigning on local issues. And if you're going to spend your time arguing that you should be sending aid to Ukraine, then your base is going to think that's money that could be coming to me, even though it's not, it's in a different side of the ledger and all that. But they think it's money that could be coming to my local hospital, and you're giving it to Ukraine. I'm standing with Trump and I'm not going to vote you in. So these people are afraid to lose their jobs, but they believe very strongly in support to Ukraine. And that's such a problem, that if this was a secret vote, a secret ballot, get through easily, you know. And it's really frustrating. And then there are all the ways that it can get through Congress. You've had a bill that's passed through Senate 70-29. If the House of Representatives just voted on that bill, it would probably get through. There would be enough people to do that, and that'd be the best, the fullest version of aid to Ukraine. You've got two what are called discharge petitions that are still hanging around, one a Democrat one, which is that same bill, just that would get it through. And then you've got a Republican one, which is changing it around. And then you've got what is likely to happen next week. So after recess, Mike Johnson is likely to take that Republican discharge petition bill. Sorry, people don't understand all of what's going on here, but likely to take that bill and then change it and make it slightly worse, and then take that back to the House of Representatives. And then that would have to be voted on, I presume, by Senate again. And the end result is that this takes forever and we still haven't got aid to Ukraine.
And his motivations beyond saving his own seat, of course, murky at this point. And the motivations behind those that are advising him in his behaviour are murky as well. And this leads me sort of to the last, I think, thing to focus on. We haven't even touched on the terror in Moscow and all of those sort of things that have happened last week. I mean, that's maybe one we save for the next episode, because I think, you know, terror and increasing violence within Russian society is only going to escalate dramatically. But let's stay.
But they're still
on
blaming the Ukrainians.
Of course, even today,
they're still. And you've got Tajiks being arrested for funding that. Look, we're arresting people for funding it, but still saying, but it's Ukraine. And the ISIS has said, no, it was us. And here's a video evidence to prove it. And they're like, oh, thanks for that, but it's Ukraine, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway,
it's incredibly murky, isn't it? And I know there are.
I don't know. I think it's pretty bloody clear.
It's clear. Well, it is clear it's not Ukraine. It's not exactly clear if this was a pure terrorist attack that just sort of happened for the reasons given, or whether it was allowed in some way by a faction or whoever. It's murky. I'm going to explore that in an episode, because there's some really interesting reportage coming out and analysis coming out in Russian language, which I'm going to be sharing on the channel. Let's stay with Trump and resurgent Trumpism, because what it seems to me, and this is a real sort of deja vu from 2016, there seems to be a process of normalization that takes place in the media and even society as well. And this is the veneration of, say, offices of state, like the office of president. So when someone like Trump assumes these offices of state, there's a process of normalization that takes place, where even the most bonkers, wacky, incredible sort of things are happening. And somehow there's a constant process of trying to convince ourselves that these are not extraordinary times, and they do not require extraordinary measures. There's this kind of normalization, toleration that takes place, which I see as extremely dangerous. Whereas there's far less focus on venerating actual institutions or the checks and balances and traditions within a country that maintain democracy, and actually far less awareness of them than, say, there is in Ukraine about the various checks and balances, because they've only recently built them, because they've built them after having an extensive period without independence and under autocracy. So there's far greater awareness amongst those who are politically literate there about those checks and balances. So I know it's a bit of a rambling question, but how would you tackle this process of normalization, which seems to be an extraordinary risk to democracy?
Absolutely. So you've got the Overton window, which is this idea that things are acceptable to talk about within the window. And historically, we never would have talked about that. It's absolutely bonkers. But over time, that Overton window can shift. And as it gets chipped away, as we start mentioning, oh, we'll talk about this, we'll talk about that. And then now you're getting like people in American politics, for example, saying outright fascistic things in public and outright racist things and outright stuff that you just, like, 20 years ago would have just been a big no-no. And that normalization is dangerous, and it comes under the guise of freedom of speech. And anyone that advocates for freedom of speech generally, like, I'm a big advocate of freedom of speech, but I don't go on about it all the time, because actually, generally, if you're someone that does that, it just means you want the freedom to be able to insult someone or say something that's somewhat dubious, right?
And so, freedom of responsible speech, that's what you're, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And this then comes down to what we do in fighting the disinformation war. How do we tackle censorship of social media when Russia have troll farms that are literally feeding the world's information space with disinformation? Like, would we sit back in a real war and just go, oh, look, Russia have just invaded. Oh, look, they've got a freedom to move, those guys. They've got a freedom to bear arms. They've got a freedom to shoot our people. Oh, they're taking over from the country. Oh, right. Like, no, so we'd fight back against that kind of invasion. What are we doing to fight back against the disinformation invasion? Like, what are we doing to tackle the narratives that are being promulgated by the nefarious institutions sitting behind, sitting inside Russia and inside Moscow? We are just, we are not fighting back in the information space. So that is a real problem I have. But anyway, normalization. So There is this normalization that's taking place in our information spaces of what it's okay to talk about and what it's okay then to believe. And then we are shifting. I think that has shifted to the right. And I think the far right has become far more acceptable now. And I think that's been a gradual thing. We've seen that around the world. I personally think that, you know, when you had the far right in the UK, you used to have things like the National Front and all these iterations of far right movements that were just not acceptable. And what's happening is that over time, they were just reinventing themselves until they got close enough to the center or close enough to the acceptable right where people went, oh, now I can do that. Yeah, now that's all right. Okay, so you could argue, and this would be controversial, there'd be loads of people voting for UKIP and blah, blah, blah. But in the UK, you might see it as something like that. And then once they're acceptable, then you can start dragging your people back further to the right. And I'm sure you can make arguments for the left as well, so on and so forth. But I think now in say, the US, you've got like quite fascistic movements that some of the more fringy movements are really challenging for the US. And what you want in place is the checks and balances. And here then goes to what you were saying, is the checks and balances in the US are themselves being, I think, minimalizing their importance. So you've got Trump at the moment being had up in court for a number of things, but he's stacked the courts previously. So actually in some of these court cases, he's getting preferential treatment to some degree. There's delays, Eileen Cannon and whatnot, delaying things. So, you know, waiting for him to become president before they actually go to court, and then they'll be kind of thrown out or whatever. And these checks and balances are not as effective as they should be. So the idea that the Constitution was sacred is now no longer as prevalent in the US as it was, because the Constitution as a form of the checks and balances are the legal institutions you have to interpret the Constitution to then apply that to society. But it's always about the Constitution. Well, now it appears that Trump can do stuff that is fairly unconstitutional. Talk about January the 6th, talk about a number of things. And then you can talk about emoluments clauses and this and that. And you're thinking, okay, here's a guy that should be had up in court. But the checks and balances are not effective on him. Why? Because he has become idolized. He is like, we are getting to, like, he wants to be that big boy bully or autocrat, because we've heard him say it directly about people like Viktor Orban, that hot mic moment the other week where he said, I want people to sit up straight and kind of not answer back type thing, like they do with Kim Jong-un. And you're like, hang on, you've just like, you're waxing lyrical about autocrats here and despots, but that's what he wants. And he's getting this idol worship. And anyone that criticizes that idol, it's then blasphemy. So you're moving from the constitutional representative democracy and republic in the US, and you're moving, like he wants to move it towards some kind of North Korean style, almost divine worship of this. I mean, he compared himself to Jesus Christ on Easter, right? You've got this Trumpian reverence that he wants, and that is a way of bashing checks and balances over the head, and it's just deeply worrying. I think there are so many things to worry about in the direction of democracy in the US, and let alone the rest of the world, that I think if Trump gets in, I don't want to be so super anti-Trump here, but if Trump gets in, that's a really big worry for US democracy. And therefore, a really big worry then for support for Ukraine, because who does he? I mean, he said not one penny, according to Viktor Orban, will go from the US to assist Ukraine. Well, he's pretty much told you what he feels.
I think Orban is in a good position to know what that policy is going to be. What you've described there is a sort of situation of sectarian constitutionalism. That's people basically saying, well, the Constitution is whatever we want it to be.
Well, in a sense, it kind of is. The Constitution is a written document and you can amend it. And so, although it's had this sacrosanct position in US history, it is just a piece of paper with words. And it's only meaningful if you interpret it in a particular way and then turn that into law and then have law enforcement agencies that enact that law. I mean, so I don't want to get too philosophical here, but like, there is no essence, you know, there's nowhere in the ether where the Constitution exists, right? It's not an objective fact. It is a fact only in as much as it affects people in America on a daily basis through how it is interpreted and enacted through law and then enforced. And so if you get control over putting in judges into the Supreme Court. So Trump at the moment, I think he's one of the most successful presidents in history because he got, I know some have done more than this, but he got three judges that were conservative judges into a 9-judge Supreme Court, which means that it has a 6-3 conservative to liberal majority, which means that the checks and balances that are put in place, like the Supreme Court and the lower courts as well, that you also stacked, are checks and balances that work in his favor. And this is a problem of getting your judiciaries aligned with your politics and why there should be very clear separations. This is a problem with Viktor Orban and what he's been doing, the democratic backsliding in Hungary, and what the worry is for Slovakia as well with Robert Fico's populist government, and what was happening to some degree with PIS in Poland, is that you start messing around with your press and manipulating your press and manipulating your judiciaries, and you are sliding towards autocracy.
And yeah. It's a very dangerous route. It's one that Russia doesn't necessarily initiate, doesn't fully control the process, but it will throw petrol on the fire when it can. And the democratic slide is absolutely in Putin's favor.
That's a really good point. So sometimes Russia amplify views that aren't necessarily wrong. They aren't automatically wrong. They're not a priori, this is disinformation. So they might say, right, you might be someone in the EU or in the UK who believes immigration is genuinely an issue, right? And I'm not saying it is or isn't. I'm trying to be neutral here, right? The Kremlin will realize that immigration is a hot button topic and it's incredibly divisive. And so they will amplify certain views. Now, it's very easy to say, well, that's come from the Kremlin, so we need to throw the baby out with the bathwater. But actually, sometimes they are amplifying genuine grievances that people have, but almost presenting it into like being the only grievance, because they are amplifying it to the point where it's the only voice you hear. And then you just have that becoming a much bigger divisive issue in whatever country you're talking about. And the Kremlin are superb at doing this. Right? Russia have got such a good experience now of troll farms and bot farms to manipulate public thought. And again, go back to this point that what the bloody hell are we doing about it? What are we doing to fight back with a positive narrative? We don't have to lie like they might lie on very, very often. We can present a positive view of what I don't know, Russia should look like, or Slovakia should look like, or Hungary should look like, or then point out points in history where Russia screwed over Hungary. Point that out to the Hungarian. We need to be strategic with our truths and amplify those truths back to people strategically to fight back, because we at the moment are sitting back and letting Russia dictate their narrative to us.
We're on that call to action to fight back on multiple fronts, but including the informational front, and renew our democracies if we want them to survive. Jonathan, thanks so much. As always, massively stimulating talking. I very much look forward to the next time. And just a heads up, I will be coming onto your channel later in the week. So we'll post a link to that. I hope people enjoy this conversation and the one to come.
I promise I won't do quite as much talking as I've done today, mate.
Not at all. Well, it'll be my turn to do the talking, but feel free to tell me if I'm talking nonsense. That'll be absolutely, yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jonathan. I really appreciate it, and keep up this sterling work. And it's incredible to see. I mean, it's great to see your Ben Hodges interview get a load of traction recently. And that's something I'll probably talk to you about when we speak next.
Let's discuss that one. I worked actually pretty hard on the questions for that one, so I'm glad to see it's doing so well.
Excellent stuff.
Speak next time.